I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast Special Edition, Emergency Edition, July 24th, 2019. Bob Mueller testified before the House Judiciary Committee. He testified before the House Intelligence Committee today. It was not what a lot of people were expecting. It was dramatic in some respects, a letdown in other respects, and pretty interesting in still other respects, both atmospherically and content-wise. We have a great group to talk about it, none of whom I can see because I am in an undisclosed location somewhere very far away. But in the Jungle Studio, we have Susan Hennessy, Bob Bauer, Margaret Taylor, and Jim Baker, none of whom need any introduction to this audience, so I will not give one. We will just launch in. Margaret, get us started. Give us an overview of what happened today.
So I think that, you know, you gave kind of a good overview. I think there were different expectations about Bob Mueller and how he was going to react to this coming in. I think there was probably less energy and less sort of the sorts of moments that a lot of people had been hoping for from him. But what I would say is that I was quite impressed at how organized the members were and how familiar they were with the report. I think they really showed their familiarity with it. They quoted from it. They had specific, you know, places in the report that they were asking about, and they were prepared for Bob Mueller to not be, you know, have a lot of exposition and a lot of, you know, long responses to their questions. They knew that was going to happen. They came in prepared. They came in ready to hit certain points, not do a lot of repetition, and get through a lot of, you know, factual laydown. And I think it was really important for that to happen. You know, this is Congress's really their opening gambit to just start laying down a congressional record of what the Mueller report is. The Mueller report itself is an executive branch document. And this is, you know, Article One. This is the Congress now taking that report and putting their own sort of gloss on it and really laying down what it found into the congressional record.
Margaret, before I move on, I want to focus on that point that which you made to us this morning, and I think is really interesting. You know, the Mueller report has been out there for a matter of months now. It's not a secret what's in it. What is the difference between it being out there and available to Congress and it being part of the congressional Article One record as opposed to part of the Article Two or public factual record?
I think the difference is that it's, in my opinion, it's really the beginning of the Congress starting to own this narrative, own this story, own what happened here. There's been this really long time period while Bob Mueller was doing his work, and including sort of afterward while everyone was digesting the report, where, you know, Congress just wasn't owning it yet. And it to me, at least, it seemed today that Congress really started to own this, and that it's for them, it's in some ways the beginning of a process. And a couple of the members referred to this. You know, they said, thank you for doing this work, but, you know, Special Counsel Mueller, it really lays the predicate for our work going forward. And so I think the question, you know, that we don't know the answer to yet is, where exactly is it going? I think there's clear indications that they're going to call some of the very important fact witnesses. For example, Don McGahn, it seems like they're going to go through a judicial process to compel his testimony. I'm sure there will be other fact witnesses compelled as well. And so where are they headed? Is this headed towards impeachment? Is it headed or not? But it seemed to me that this is the beginning of that process and of Congress really, really owning this whole story.
Bob, your impressions, was the day more or less what you expected it to be? And to the extent it was different, how?
it was more or less what I expected it to be. I didn't have high expectations. It was clear that Mueller had hoped that his report would speak for itself. I had, in many respects, though understanding the Congress's concerns, had hoped that they would abide by Mueller's express wishes and let the report speak for itself. And then came the predictable business in this hearing where Democrats hoped, and I'll put this in two parts, either to bring out more dramatically what was already in the report or conceivably to lure from Mueller a statement that went somewhat beyond the report, either as a matter of tone or emphasis or maybe even as in the Ted Lieu exchange that he later clarified, you know, something dramatically different, something significantly different. And then, of course, the Republicans had in mind to bring out all their talking points about the deficiencies of the report and the ways in which the report, the whole process, was unfair to President Trump. I understand what Margaret is saying. At the same time, I have to say that if the hearing was an important foundation to lay for a constructive public debate that to some degree overcomes divides and at least begins to create something more than we've seen up to this time. And what we've seen up to this time is sort of polarization. Democrats see things one way and Republicans see things another. I don't think this report advances us toward that objective. Excuse me, that hearing advances us toward that objective.
Do you share Margaret's sense that the performance of members, and I think particularly Democratic members here, was more impressive and coordinated and tight in organization and interrogative direction than we normally see from members or had reason to expect from these members?
Yes, I think that you did see some more discipline. Of course, this was a witness who had made it very clear what the limits of his testimony was going to be, and they had ample notice of that. So they organized very effectively around those parameters. It's a relatively rare case that a witness comes in and says, I'm going to talk about X and only X based on Y, a written text, and I'm not going beyond it. They understood that was the challenge, and they addressed it. So you would have to give them credit for that, certainly, because had they tried to do it differently, it would have been, I think it would have been very unsuccessful and very unhelpful to what they were trying to accomplish.
Susan, what did you think? Are you more in the this was more or less as expected, or are you more in the this was better than expected, or was it worse than expected? I can make an argument that it was worse than expected, and I'm curious whether you know how you see it. Are you, do you feel better at the end of the day than you did at the beginning, or worse, or about the same?
So I think I would bifurcate my answer into two parts, one being sort of Mueller's performance and the other being the performance of Congress. So Mueller's performance was about what I expected, a little bit worse, especially, you know, he got much stronger in the HPSI hearing, in part because we were seeing better questions, in part because he was more comfortable. The beginning of the Judiciary Committee hearing was, he struggled to sort of find a rhythm and answer the questions. And, that said, I never expected, you know, Bob Mueller to come in and be this sort of charismatic person that was going to bring the report to life. I think that was always a fantasy from the beginning. The place in which the hearings went much better than I expected, it's actually the place where it really matters, and that's the performance of members of Congress, particularly congressional Democrats. And that's that, you know, we really did see Democrats being focused on the substance of the report. We saw Democrats who had read the report were offering sort of page citation. I thought that sort of the mode of using sort of slides and pull quotes was actually rather effective. We saw a number of members of the House Judiciary Committee basically taking turns, right? Each people developing a different sort of thread. Each one of them used their 5 minutes to say, this episode of obstruction, this is what we're going to talk about for this 5 minutes. And then the next person would say, now we're going to move on to the next episode of obstruction. And actually, we saw members of Congress that had coordinated themselves to cover really an extraordinary amount of ground. The thing that I thought was most significant on the Republican side was less the idea that they were sort of, you know, off on kind of conspiracy theories about the origin of the investigation or attempting to discredit Mueller, something that I think they were relatively ineffective about doing. I think what was most significant about the Republican members is the sort of the implicit assumption in all of their questions that the report was factually accurate, right? So they were accepting kind of as a given when they went about their questioning that, you know, Don McGahn is telling the truth and Donald Trump is lying, that Jim Comey is telling the truth, that Donald Trump is lying. Those are the Republican members. They weren't engaging Mueller as sort of, you know, attempting to dispute the facts. They were off on conspiracy theories and then arguing about sort of the legal significance of those facts. And I actually think that's a huge step forward for us. For the past couple of years, we've been operating in different factual universes. And part of Bob Mueller's job was to put a record on the table and say, okay, we're all going to have a different understanding of what this means legally and politically and for the country. But this is our common understanding of what occurred. And I actually think we saw evidence in this hearing that he has accomplished that goal. I think that's really significant, and I do think it's a reason to be optimistic. I think the seriousness and the discipline with which we saw the majority engage today is a reason to be optimistic that they are prepared to engage in the kind of serious, sustained oversight that this is going to require over the coming, you know, months, if not years.
Jim, do you buy that? Because I look at it and I say, well, yeah, they didn't contest the facts of the Mueller report, but I don't know that they're operating on the same set of facts either, because the Democrats are operating in the factual universe in which every sentence in Bob Mueller's report is, you know, the gospel truth that was just handed down directly from God. And the only question is what to do with it. And the Republicans are operating in a factual universe in which the Mueller report was never written. The only things that have ever happened is that, you know, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page exchanged a bunch of text messages, and Chris Steele got some disinformation from the Russians, and something happened with Joseph Mifsud, right? And and Robert Mueller hired a bunch of Democrats. And so it's not that I agree with Susan that they're not contesting any of the facts of the Mueller report, but they're not exactly operating on the basis of those facts either. And so how do you see it? Do you see, like, are we in a convergent factual universe, or are we simply in disparate parallel factual universes?
So this part of the conversation makes me think about art. And so an art being an abstraction from reality. And so I think about three people looking at a scene, and one comes up with an impressionist picture. One comes up with a realist picture that's very, you know, factually accurate with respect to that, and somebody else comes up with, I don't know what, German expressionism or something. I mean, I agree that everybody is looking at the facts. I don't think the Republicans really, you know, undermine the report in any factual way, so I agree completely with Susan, but they just seem to be, they look at reality and see what they want to see through their prisms, and I think that's what we're sort of stuck in right now. So to answer your question, that's what I think about this.
By Jim's analogy, Louis Gohmert is finger painting.
Maybe, yeah.
He's doing clay. He's just operating in a completely different medium.
Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was just going to, I'll riff on that for a minute, on the art thing for a second. I mean, one of the things to me today, so look, if the idea behind this was, and I think it should have been, and I think most people were thinking about that, at least on the Democratic side, to educate the American people in a better way about what was in the report, I think while it succeeded maybe in some ways, I think it was not successful overall because in large part of the format. So I think this form of art, the hearing, I think when we look back, this will be either the sort of the start of the decline or the example of the decline. I think the hearing as a mechanism for educating the public is dead. I don't think it really works anymore. Most Americans don't have 7 hours to sit there and watch TV all day. They have jobs, they're working, and it's going to get boiled down by, you know, a variety of news media and politicians and so on, and fed to them in bits and pieces throughout the rest of the evening as they watch their shows and listen to podcasts and whatever. So I think I don't have a solution to that, but that was one of the things that struck me today, that this format just doesn't work anymore for conveying information.
And so that's actually a really interesting transition to talking about Bob Mueller's performance, because, you know, when if you imagine translating this into, you know, 30-second sound bites of exchanges between him and members, you can do that in a way that brings out a lot of interesting points and does exactly what Margaret was describing at the beginning, which is sort of making vivid the fact that we're now developing a congressional record of this material. Or you can do it in a way that frankly makes Bob Mueller look really bad, because he fumbles a lot of the time. He's, you know, not obviously in full command of the record before him. And he is certainly not in this setting, you know, charismatic and making points, and he trips over things, and members, you know, he has a number of pretty bad moments today. Jim, were you, I mean, you know him and have worked with him, were you surprised by just his affect and performance today, or is this just who Bob Mueller is as a public presence?
It was a bit of both, I think. I mean, he did, I don't think he started out in the best way possible. And what popped into my head was thinking about, you know, if you're watching the Super Bowl, at the start of that, oftentimes the teams are like playing terribly. It's like, what's going on? Well, they're all nervous. I mean, they're just, it's a big platform. Even for him, he's testified many, many times, but he hasn't testified in a while. And he's never testified in a setting like this. And it's stressful when you're in a room like that. And I've testified a lot. It's stressful anyway, but I've never testified in a circumstance like this either. You know, with all those cameras and everything like that, I mean, how can you not be, you know, as a normal person, just nervous? So he seemed very nervous. And then he seemed very, either the department and or, you know, Bob and his team had put so many constraints around how he was going to testify. Another image that popped into my head was that he was kind of trapped in a china cabinet, and he didn't like want to turn one way or the other out of fear of breaking something that he didn't want to break. And so he just was seemed extremely constrained, and I think he was trying to figure out his way for the first hour or so. And I think by the time he got to the afternoon, it was much better, for there's a variety of different reasons. So it was not his best performance, I will say that. I think at the end of the day, he conveyed what he wanted to convey. Nobody put words in his mouth on either side. And so, you know, he's a prosecutor who wants to talk about the facts, who's not going to take any, you know, rhetorical leaps. He does not want to be the political pawn of anybody. But he's also, so that's just how he is. And he's not a storyteller. And he's certainly not a showman. And he is not going to get out there and portray some narrative just for the sake of portraying it. He made clear that he didn't want to be there. He made clear that his report was his testimony, and he was going to stick to that as closely as possible.
So, Margaret, you seem to be the most optimistic about how the day went. To what extent do you think the performance of the witness undermined the effort that you're describing to create the record for Congress?
I don't think it undermined it necessarily. I mean, I guess I'm a person who did not come into this thinking it was going to be some big game changer. And so maybe my expectations were a little bit different from others. The way I think about it, I guess, is like, you know, I watched the whole thing. I was there for 7 hours watching it. And, you know, I asked myself at the end, you know, could someone come away from these two hearings saying to themselves, wow, there's really no there with this whole Mueller report thing. And it really was a witch hunt. And I feel like for anyone seriously watching this thing, you can't possibly come away with that thought. And so I guess for me, I was really looking at the substance, and I felt like the members, the Democrats, just really laid down a ton of substance that will be referred to later as they move forward in their investigation over and over and over and over again. So to me, it was a process of laying a foundation. They did what they could with this witness who had some limitations about how he was going to be presenting himself. So I was just really looking at it from a very substantive standpoint. And I think that's where maybe I'm coming down where I'm coming.
Bob, I want to look at it from the point of view of the White House. So, you know, you've been White House counsel at a time when there were significant congressional investigations of the White House or of White House activity that the White House has significant equities with respect to. If you were Pat Cipollone today and you had watched this, do you feel like things are under control for you, or do you feel like now they're going to sue for Don McGahn and that this kind of keeps a train running downhill that may be uncoupled and get out of control, or maybe already is under control? How are you feeling today if you're White House counsel?
It's a difficult question, putting oneself into the mind of a lawyer for Donald Trump. But I would say that I had a lawyer for a client. I had a constitutional lawyer for a client. I mean, there are many differences that I could identify here that made my job a lot easier than Pat Cipollone's or certainly Don McGahn's. But let me suggest this. I think I don't know how Pat Cipollone thinks about these things, but I think if I tried to think about it as a White House counsel under Trump might have, I would have thought at the very outset that the hearing posed probably very little danger to the president, in the following sense, that Democrats in the Congress and the constituency of Democrats who will observe this hearing are quite convinced already that Mueller has turned in a damning report. I share that view, by the way, just to put that out of the table. So I'm not being critical of Mueller's conclusions here or the significance of what he found. And I happen to have said, at least on one occasion, I thought very well of the work that he did under extraordinarily difficult circumstances in a role that is virtually an impossible role, this role of special counsel in many respects. But I would have known that the Democrats needed to do what they did today, but I don't think it fundamentally affects the pressures that will drive them in one direction or another on this issue. If they start to move toward a formal impeachment inquiry, they will have moved toward that formal impeachment inquiry whether or not they called Robert Mueller, and especially given the constraints that he put on his testimony, regardless of how this hearing had turned out, because it wasn't going to turn out dramatically one way or the other. So I wouldn't have expected Democrats to break ranks on these issues, and I certainly would not have expected Republicans to break ranks on these issues. I think Jim Baker makes a very good point about the hearing format. I don't think anybody could have realistically expected that this was going to significantly change minds, both the length and the format, and in truth, the sustained exposure to this issue that Americans have had for a long period of time, and the way this turns out as an issue to have sort of sorted out within the polarized politics of our time. So I think had I been Pat Cipollone, I would have assumed that we would end up at the end of the day where we were on substance, that is to say with a damning report that Republicans are prepared to set to the side and Democrats are prepared not to, and I don't know how much of a difference this Mueller hearing made. One point about Bob Mueller's testimony, and it goes again to this very interesting point that Jim Baker raised about hearings, and I just want to underscore it. He could not testify, which was his preference, which I fully understood. He could testify and put himself under these significant constraints, and that I think given his reputation and his role was probably a perfectly sound choice on his part. But there was a third alternative, and for want of that alternative, there were some very strange responses or lack of opportunity to educate in the way that we're talking about. So, for example, when the question was raised whether the Trump campaign activity in relation to foreign nationals offering campaign support would constitute a crime? His answer was yes, given certain circumstances. When he was responding to questions about obstruction, I noted one in particular where the answer that he gave was, well, I can't subscribe to that particular characterization. I don't have the language immediately in front of me. Yes, I now do. I can't subscribe necessarily to the way you analyze it. I'm not certain. At one point, he says that I can agree with your characterization. So there are all these questions that are hanging out there and these highly ambiguous responses that he gave. I think if you were looking at this as an educational moment, that's one way in which it fell short. I'm not blaming Mueller. I think he had to make a choice. The choice he made was the one he made. One other point that I want to raise, which I thought one of the most interesting responses that he gave that he was not asked to follow up on, he didn't follow up on unless I missed it. And that was that in an exchange early on, when he was challenged by a Republican member over, on the one hand, his adherence to a formal prosecutorial role, and on the other hand, to the famous "I'm not exonerating" language. And the Republican pressed him on the point, how do you square the traditional prosecutorial role with your saying that you couldn't exonerate? How do you square that? How the two can be reconciled? And he responded by saying it's a unique situation. But he was interrupted, and nothing more was said on the subject. That's the whole game here. That's the whole clue to the Mueller report, that it is a unique situation. So in some ways, he's there saying, I'm a prosecutor, and I'm going to operate like a prosecutor. But he's not just a prosecutor, and he can't just operate like a prosecutor. He teased out the suggestion there was something different here, and there wasn't any further discussion on the subject.
So I want to jump in for a minute with a defense of the hearing format. And that's whenever you think about the task that the Democrats have here, which is that you have a 448-page report, and you have to go over the same ground again and again to sort of get sort of that breakthrough into the public consciousness to engage with these issues with additional depth. Just today, you know, I've read the Mueller report back to back multiple times. I've deeply engaged with the text. There were things today that I said, isn't that new? And somebody else said, no, it's on this page of the report. It is a tremendously dense, complicated document. You have to spend a lot of time with it. And so if you're going to have to do this thing where you're going back and you're kind of talking about the same story and different pieces of the same story again and again and again, in a media environment in which everybody is completely overwhelmed all the time, the White House is producing these absolutely insane stories, often on an hourly rather than a daily basis. You need a witness. You need a new person to tell that story from their perspective, in their language, answering those questions, because that's what makes it new. And so when you're in the situation in which Mueller has put this whole story on the table, and then the job is to deconstruct the story, to decide on the significance of the story, to debate the legal aspects of the story over a long period of time, I don't know how you do that successfully unless you kind of use a trial strategy that involves first calling the police officer, calling the detective to the witness stand and asking for his story, and then getting your fact witnesses in there and starting to have them tell the story, their perspective, the same thing over and over again. And while I agree the hearing was dispiriting in a lot of ways, it was confusing. I don't think it made the kind of great TV people might thought it might have. I think the book was better than the movie in this case. I actually don't think there are a lot of alternatives, and I think effectively used, oversight hearings actually do have a lot of power, not just in what we saw today, but more importantly moving forward.
The book is better than the movie, maybe, but I just want to say the podcast is better than either. And Susan, you are speaking like somebody who has had to think in narrative terms for 6 weeks or so. I actually want to double down on what Susan said and challenge the premise that this isn't changing minds. And I'm saying this not because I necessarily believe it, but because I want to put it in front of Jim and Bob, who seem like our biggest doubters of the efficacy of hearings, of this hearing format. And so, Jim, see what you think of this. I agree that there are probably not a lot of people who believed this morning in a deep state conspiracy to frame the president and have a coup, who watched that hearing and said, oh my, I was wrong. There's actually a serious question here about the way, or a serious set of questions about the way the president interacted with this Russian operation or this set of Russian operations, and certainly the way he interacted with the investigation of it. My God, you know, I was completely wrong. I agree that that, in that sense, minds have not been changed. But I do think the sense in which minds probably are being changed is the sense of momentum that exists on the Democratic side. And today, after the hearing, Nancy Pelosi, who of course opposes an impeachment inquiry, had to appear with the two chairmen to, emphasize her commitment to moving forward on these investigations. And I do think that there's a sense in which the more of this stuff you do, the more ineluctably you kind of end up moving in the direction of impeachment. And that's not changing minds between people who don't believe the premise and people who do believe in the investigative findings, but it does have the effect of moving people who are disturbed into the camp of the more disturbed rather than the less disturbed. So, Jim, what do you think? Is maybe are you doubting the efficacy of hearings because you already know what you think, and so it's sort of not. But the people who, for whom reinforcement, hey, this is really important, who know at some level that it's important and upsetting, but it actually does matter to see Bob Mueller up there say, agreeing with Adam Schiff, yeah, this raises patriotism questions.
Well, so yes, I mean, maybe I'm biased because of my interaction with the report and the investigation and so on. I guess if I think about it for a second, let me just back way up, Ben. So what is the goal of the Democrats at this point in time at the highest level? The goal, I think, is to limit Donald Trump's time in office as much as possible. And that will either be through impeachment and conviction, which is highly unlikely, or through the election in November of 2020 and the end of his term in January of 2021. Okay, so my question then is, did this format change the minds of enough people that makes that more likely than it was when we started the day? And I guess I'm just not sure about that. I don't know what the exact percentage is. 40% of the country, you know, thinks this whole thing is a hoax and ridiculous, and they're not about to change their minds. 40% of the country really does not like Donald Trump and wants him out of office as soon as possible. And then there's that middle. And so, did this endeavor today change their minds? I don't know. I mean, I take your point. I take Susan's point. Look, we had a full day. You know, the TV was dominated by this for 7 hours today. So people are talking about it, and there are clips and analysis and things going on throughout the day, and there will be the rest of the week, and then probably be talking about it on Sunday. So it'll be a sustained event over a period of time, and so maybe it will reach the minds of more people who had thought something different about the report prior to today. I'm just not sure that this was done in the most efficient way possible that makes this information the most accessible. It makes it as accessible as it could be to a variety of different people who perhaps don't have fully formed views on the report or can have their minds changed. I mean, just to back up, though, as Susan was speaking, I was thinking about, okay, presenting a case to a jury, right, where you have to tell us, especially like in a complicated case, where you have to tell the story to the jury in a way that they can understand in a legal format with, you know, the defense counsel there who can object and the judge that can rule on a variety of different things and will keep order. And you have to figure out within the constraints of that environment how to effectively lay out to them what the story is and what happened. And I guess to me, yeah, maybe calling the cop or the investigator at the outset, I think, may not have been the best thing here. Calling other witnesses first, trying to build more of a story, and maybe saving Mueller for later for sort of cleanup might have been a better way to go about it, because it's still sort of bloodless, right? You don't have Don McGahn there. You don't have Corey Lewandowski. You don't have some other protagonists in the story making it real. People who were in the room talking to Donald Trump. I mean, really, I guess, you know, Jim Comey is one of the few people that we've had in that regard. So I don't know. I mean, I'm struggling to think about whether this is the most effective way to present it and whether enough minds were changed for the Democrats to achieve their objectives.
Margaret, Jim's point raises a really interesting tactical question for Congress, which is, what is their next step? So the Wall Street Journal reports this afternoon, right after the hearing, that the House is readying a suit over Don McGahn's testimony. What do we know about the state of both the state of existing litigation, but also what can we reasonably expect them to do next? So it's, you know, Mueller is, as Jim puts it, not batting cleanup. He's their leadoff hitter. Whether that's the right decision or the wrong decision, it's the one they made. So, if we assume that this is the first act of the congressional side, what's the next play?
So, to answer your question about the current state of litigation, as you and I have discussed in the Lawfare podcast several times, you know, there are several ongoing cases in courts going on right now that are making their way through the courts. So far, the rulings have generally been in Congress's favor. I do think that the Nancy Pelosi and Democratic leadership in the House are looking for more wins in the courts to buttress their efforts. I think they'll continue to pursue those. I think they're doing the right thing by pursuing Don McGahn's testimony through court proceedings. My understanding is that there's this disagreement about. There have been negotiations going on between the committee and the White House. The disagreement is over whether Don McGahn's testimony was going to be private, sort of with the committee behind closed doors, or public. And my impression is that the committee is insisting, no, Don McGahn will testify publicly. I think that's the only way for them to get a kind of more of a star witness up there. And so I do think Don McGahn could be a pretty explosive star witness if they do get him up there and ask him these questions. Again, even just asking him questions about things that are in the Mueller report, a lot of that stuff is pretty damning. And so what I see is them pursuing a pretty methodical course, using the courts to the extent that that is advantageous for moving the investigation forward. And, you know, at this point, maybe playing a little bit more hardball with the White House with these more high profile witnesses that could be really, really important if they get into a public setting and are able to confirm a lot of these pretty sort of, again, damning things that are in the report itself.
Margaret, and just to clarify, unlike Bob Mueller, if you actually could get Don McGahn there and you could get past presumably certain executive privilege claims, unlike Bob Mueller, he is not limited by the text of the report, right? You could ask him anything.
Well, certainly, I mean, you can ask him anything. What he would sort of decide he felt comfortable saying, I think, is a different question. But you know, again, I think there's just so much of the report depends on, particularly in the obstruction piece, depends on him. And if he could be up there sort of just telling that story with a little bit more color, I think that could be pretty, you know, moving for people who are really for people who are concerned about whether the president has, you know, engaged in obstructive acts or not.
May I step in on this one? So first of all, let me just as a background matter say, you wrote a piece quite some time ago, Ben. You may have co-authored it with Susan or Quinta, I can't recall, but about the time having come to initiate impeachment proceedings. That was quite some time ago. And just as a way of laying out on the table sort of our general judgments about these things against which our analysis can be measured, I thought at the time you had a strong case, and I subsequently certainly came to the conclusion that one could make a real strong case that Congress should have initiated and defended and then responsibly conducted in a phased fashion formal impeachment proceedings because I believe there's evidence that the president committed impeachable offenses. So I say that just as a starting point. However, we are now in the summer of a presidential election cycle. And the longer this takes, the more we are in a presidential election cycle. In fact, we're just a few months away from the Iowa caucuses. It is going to be very difficult to persuade, in my view, a large chunk of the public, some part of it which may very well be not enamored of Democrats but very, very troubled by Trump's conduct, that impeachment is the appropriate vehicle at this point for addressing the problem. And so while I recognize that the end game for some Democrats here was to give some momentum toward impeachment, momentum at this point is really a critical question of timing, and the timing is not in the Democrats' favors on this, in my view. That I'm not arguing that's good or bad. I'm simply saying, particularly in view of my view of Trump's behavior, it may be lamentable that Congress is now in the position where it's very difficult to make the impeachment case without the politicization of the election cycle looming over it. But I just want to stress that it's not as if it is going to be easy for the Democrats to carry the case that will have an impeachment proceeding in January of 2020. So
when do you think the last date is that you could do an impeachment and it actually not be, sort of a giant stamp in the forehead of the presidential candidate of the Democratic Party?
I don't really know. I mean, if you assume now we don't have July is gone, August is gone, then we get into September. We're talking here about lawsuits to get McGahn freed up for potential testimony, other critical witnesses. You're now deep into the fall. Subtract Thanksgiving, subtract Christmas. By that point, the Democrats will have had 6 or 7 presidential debates, and then we're 4 weeks out from the Iowa caucuses. This is not a favorable calendar from the standpoint of public opinion about how this problem should be addressed. So that was one point I just wanted to stress. The second point I want to make is about McGahn. If I had to guess, and there's a lot that could happen between now and then and the circumstances in which he comes to testify, if he does at all, and how it's structured, I would not expect colorful, explosive testimony. I think McGahn will be extraordinarily careful about how he approaches it if he ever comes before the committee. He has no intention, in my judgment, knowing a little bit about McGahn's history, of committing public suicide with the Republican Party. He is a Republican. He was a Republican counsel to the Congressional Campaign Committee. He was White House counsel, mind you, and stayed on well past the point when some White House counsel might have resigned, given some of what Donald Trump subjected him to and asked him to do. He is back at his law firm running a practice that's heavily dependent on strong relationships he's built over a number of years with Republican congressional Republicans. I think it's highly implausible that he's looking to be the Republican answer to John Dean in this year or early the next. I just don't expect that at all.
All right, so Jim, I'm going to put you on the spot on this. If the hearing is a bad form, and Bob Mueller isn't your star witness, and Don McGahn's not going to be your star witness, and you're going to have to litigate the heck out of anything to get anybody else, and oh, by the way, the clock is running out before anything you do has such electoral consequences that you'll be super reticent about doing this. What do you do if you're the Democratic House leadership facing this situation? Do you just kind of throw in the towel and say, all right, we'll use hearings as a kind of Benghazi-like harassment vehicle in order to sort of soften the battlefield for whoever turns out to be the candidate? Maybe we'll introduce some legislation, but we're not actually going to do anything. Or do you say something else? Like I think like a lot of the conversation here has been sort of saying, identifying option after option as suboptimal or bad. So like, are there any good options?
So with the giant caveat that I am far from being a politician of any sort, let alone a good one, and that's probably a good thing. I don't completely know, Ben, but I guess I would start with the people least likely to have any ability to assert any type of privilege, like Corey Lewandowski, like Donald Trump Jr., people who are not government employees, have not been government employees in the relevant time period, and get them up there. I don't know what kind of how they're going to resist it exactly. I mean, haven't thought through that completely, but it would strike me that the kinds of issues that Bob raises, which are real with respect to, you know, any White House counsel, those are going to be real issues that a lawyer is going to be worried about. But start with other people. Start to tell the story in some other way by putting witnesses up there and to try to convey the information in a way that, you know, if you're going to use the hearing format, that people will be able to use. I guess let me just back up one second. I mean, one thing that I did think today was about the genius and masterfulness of Donald Trump in terms of his ability to tell a story, to create a narrative, whether you agree with it or not, whether you think it's based on lies or not, whatever. He is in 2019, he has figured out how to convey information to a large group of the population that they accept and adopt. And so I don't have the solution. I don't know how you go up against that. I'm not capable of that. But this brings me back to the point I made earlier, where he's just playing on a different level. You know, I attempt to tweet from time to time, and I don't know how they come out or whatever. But I remember getting one comment on one tweet that I said something about the president, and one of my commentators responded and said, "This guy is light years ahead of you." And that has resonated with me, and I think about that a lot. And in terms of his ability to communicate effectively with a lot of people, effectively, again, in his terms, with his agenda, which I'm not making a normative judgment about at this moment, just put that aside for a second, but in terms of his ability to tell a story. So I don't know how the Democrats, you know, deal with that effectively, but given the constraints that they've got right now, given the reality, I would start with some of these witnesses who are going to be less trouble.
Margaret, I suggested exactly what Jim is suggesting right now some time back. You know, like Corey Lewandowski strikes me as the low-hanging fruit. Why is the focus not on the people? I'm making you answer for all of congressional behavior here because you're our Congress specialist. But why is the focus on so many people with arguably the strongest privilege claims rather than the universe of people who were, you know, don't obviously have a basis to resist?
I mean, I don't precisely know the answer to your question, but you know, there was a vote on a resolution that had something like, I think, 12 or 20 names or something on it. A lot recently, I'd say, you know, maybe 3 weeks ago, that had these types of names on it. So there is an intention, I think, to pursue some of these other types of people. I mean, you know, Hope Hicks in some ways is that kind of person. I mean, she was in the White House, and so there's some complications there. But, you know, she's not the White House counsel. She's the communications director. And you see, we saw what happened with her. You know, the White House just went, you know, to the mat to basically have her not be testifying in a public way. She did like a behind, you know, again, one of these private interviews. So I think the committee was sort of using that those types of people to maybe build behind the scenes a little bit more of the factual record, with the idea of going more public, you know, with some of these more high profile witnesses. So the real answer is I don't know exactly. But I do think they, you know, there is a stated intention to, you know, continue to go after those types of low profile folks. Also, I think that, you know, it may very well be the case they're pursuing a sort of everything kind of a strategy, like put everything out there, pursue everything, and, you know, see what kinds of things are sticking.
All right. I want to wrap up with, you know, this was Mueller Day. And so I want to wrap up with Bob Mueller. Susan, what are we done with Mueller now? I mean, we have his report. We have his testimony about the report. Is the world finished with, I don't mean in some cosmic sense, but I mean, is this episode and set of stories done with Mueller, or is there some remaining drama for him to, that he plays a role in with respect to the Trump presidency? And if he's done, how do you understand his legacy in this space?
So I think he is done. I think that today was the day we sort of saw Bob Mueller ride off into the sunset. And I thought the moment...
The Robert Swan song, Mueller.
Exactly. See what you did there. The moment that that really sort of sunk in with me was in an exchange. I can't remember with which member, but it was one of the Democrats who was trying to get him to walk through sort of the various elements of a particular obstructive act, right? So there's the nexus to the proceeding, and was there corrupt intent, and he's sort of walking through, and Mueller stops, and, you know, he's saying, yes, you know, I agree that element's met, or, you know, we state, the report states the element's met, and he's sort of walking through. Then he gets to the end, and he said, I just want to be clear, that doesn't mean I agree, like, the fact that I'm saying this doesn't mean I agree with your sort of characterization, right, kind of a, like, I see what you're trying to do here, which is get me to say that he broke the law, but, like, I'm not doing that. And I thought that moment was Robert Mueller saying, I did my job, and this part is your job. I've given you the report. I've told you about the behavior. I've set out the legal elements for you. I cannot decide in this context whether or not a crime was committed or not. And frankly, not because of some technicality of an OLC memo, although obviously that was a big factor here, but because the Constitution says it's your job. And, you know, I think the way to understand Mueller's legacy, as infuriating as it was, and you know, as much as I disagree with some of the substantive conclusions that he made and might have done it differently if I were in his shoes, it's fundamentally a legacy of patriotism, of somebody who was called to a challenge and attempted to respond with a sense of integrity and purpose and commitment to sort of the values of this nation. And so, you know, there's such a tremendous amount to unpack sort of about his work and about sort of his larger life. You know, that said, I think even while sitting here and feeling a lot of frustration, I feel nothing but sort of genuine gratitude, not just for Mueller's work, but especially for today, for the reminder that there are still people like Mueller out there, that as we see institutions of government being corrupted and dragged down and, you know, sort of the most basic traditions of public service being being called into question. You know, I do think that there was something to be said for seeing somebody like Robert Mueller stand up there and stick to his guns and say, you know, I'm playing by the rules as I understand them here, and you're either going to do your part or not, and that's up to you. And so that's kind of the way that I am sort of turning the page on Mueller, but you know, I really do mean sort of sincerely just the sense of gratitude and admiration for his example and optimism that that we are going to return to you know, a civil service that is not just led but sort of imbued by new people coming up from the bottom, of people who want to kind of walk in that tradition.
Margaret, what do you think? Is there a you know, one way to understand how you began and how Susan just ended is that, you know, this day is him sort of passing the torch to the Article One body, obviously not saying, hey, I'm passing you the torch, continue my work, but saying, I'm done, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing the part of this that's your job, and I'm not making judgments for you. Is that a, you know, do you think members understand that as a challenge to them to do their own work, or is there a frustration with Mueller that he didn't do more for them?
What I saw today over the course of the two hearings was the House Democrats trying genuinely very hard to be the next actor that sort of steps up and says, you know, we're going to do the right thing here, which is to, you know, really run this to ground to guard our country against foreign interference. You saw Adam Schiff doing a lot of that. I think they are very self-consciously trying to step into those shoes themselves in their role in Congress. It's very challenging in the environment that they're working in with the partisanship and, you know, seeing the facts, you know, as Jim said earlier, just seeing the facts in totally different ways. But what I saw today from the House Democrats and then the, you know, Nancy Pelosi afterward was, you know, trying to step forward in a very self-conscious way into a responsible governance role, doing the things that they are supposed to be doing under these circumstances.
Bob, what do you think? You've been critical of some of Mueller's individual judgments and decisions. You've also expressed a lot of admiration for aspects of the investigation. Do you think he's done at this point? And if so, how do you assess the contribution that he's made?
The job he was given is a very difficult one to do. I think that in some respects he played by the rules, and in other respects he frankly bent them a little bit. That is to say, he pushed pretty hard to put some information out into the public, for example, on the obstruction issue, that I think he thought might stimulate Congress, might motivate Congress to take a hard look. For example, precisely as the Republicans are so aggrieved to hear, his in effect saying, I'm not reaching a traditional determination about whether the president committed obstruction, but at the same time, I'm not exonerating him. That's not a traditional prosecutorial judgment. So I think he viewed himself in that case as acting in what he described as a unique situation as a special counsel and not just a regular prosecutor. I think overall, given the conflicts, the pressures, just the fundamental difficulties of the position, I think that he rendered an extraordinary public service. I don't know anybody who could have done it better. Each time one criticizes Mueller, it's very easy to answer or to imagine what the counter-criticism would be or the response to the criticism would be. And so I view the report as a really meaningful public contribution, and I would have probably in his place, or if given the choice, would have let it go there, would have let it sit right there and let that report speak for itself in the way that Mueller asked that it be allowed to do. So I think very highly of him. The one thing that came out in the hearing today that we all know about that I think will be debated for some time was the decision on his part not to press the president to a higher degree of cooperation and, if necessary, to have subpoenaed him and his son for their testimony. I think that is a question that came up a couple of times. It's well known that he didn't do that. The reason he gave was the need for expedition. That might have been explored, I'm not sure terribly fruitfully, at that hearing, but I think that was among other issues that we could discuss, like where he came down on the campaign finance issue. I mean, that's going to be debated for years to come. But on balance, I think he did an extraordinary job.
Jim, I want to close with you because you're the person who has the most points of contact with all of this. You worked with Bob Mueller in a number of different capacities. You were there when the investigation became the Mueller investigation began within the FBI. You were there when Bob Mueller was appointed to take it over. How do you understand his role in the whole thing, and how should we think about the contribution that Bob Mueller made?
Wow, that's a broad question. So, look, I mean, in terms of the role in this particular instance, I agree it was a very, very difficult job he had to do. I think if you a person who reads that report, you might disagree with some of the legal conclusions and some of the way they did it, but in terms of the quality of it, it's an outstanding document of you know, legal and factual analysis. It's really, you know, superb, really. So I think, you know, look, in volume two, and some folks have criticized this quite a bit in terms of what he said and his, you know, his statement about not exonerating the president. He was pushing the envelope in volume two in terms of his role, I think. But what I've thought about repeatedly in that regard is one thing that prosecutors hate, absolutely hate, is anybody that tries to screw around with the system and to interfere with their ability to get to the truth. And so to me, that just kind of comes out. And I think he was probably just reacting to that. And look, this person tried in many, many ways to interfere with my investigation, and I'm going to find a way to lay that out there, even though this OLC opinion is sitting there and makes it impossible for me to make a recommendation to prosecute. So anyway, that's sort of some of my thoughts there. I mean, I have to say I was filled with sadness in a lot of different ways throughout the day today, thinking that this is Bob's last sort of public service to the country. It very well may be. I don't know. We'll have to see. And I've dealt with him in a variety of different ways for almost 30 years. He was my immediate boss at one point in time. And, you know, he's served the country in amazing ways over the course of his career and sacrificed a lot in order to be able to do that. And you can talk about his service in Vietnam and so on. I guess one thing I would just highlight would be his service to the country on 9/11 and thereafter. I was with him on 9/11 and worked with him closely for many, many years after that. And, you know, it was a big team effort of a lot of people across the federal government and our international partners and so on. But as director, Director Mueller was critical in protecting the United States after 9/11 and ensuring that there was not another catastrophic attack on the United States. And he did it in a way that scrupulously adhered to the Constitution and laws of the United States, turning down opportunities to get involved in some stuff, let's just say, that was extremely controversial, right? And so the reason that Americans, a significant part of the reason that Americans are free and safe today is because of the service of Bob Mueller to the country.
We're going to leave it there. This has been a special emergency edition of the Lawfare podcast. As always with our emergency editions, we don't have music, so it's not being performed by Sophia Yan. We do, however, have merch, and you should buy the Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. You should also leave a rating for the Lawfare podcast. Susan and I have learned a little bit about podcast ratings in the last week, and one of the things we've learned is that it really does matter if people rate the Lawfare podcast. It's not just something we say. You know, the Lawfare podcast made it to number 9 on the iTunes chart, and it was because a whole lot of people saw that first episode of the report and jumped on it. So what I want you all to do, because you're all listeners to the emergency podcast, is go rate and review the Lawfare podcast on iTunes, and let's just flood the place with feedback to the Lawfare podcast. Tweet about it, share it on social media, and talk about it, tell friends. And once again, thanks to Jim, to Bob, to Margaret, to Susan, and to our audio engineer who put this all together this week, Michaela Fogel. And as always, thanks for listening.